So I'll tell you the moral of the story of that Tony decided not to tell you about my unknown contribution to particle physics. And the moral is to the young people here, if some old fool tells you that what you're saying is all wrong, don't believe it.
Right.
I've got a bad conscience. Those who got wet coming over here made me think that I should have put out not an abstract but an anti-abstract, the things I am not going to talk about. All right, might have saved some of you getting wet. I'm going to talk about. Let's see. What was this? That's grubby. I'm going to talk about quantum algorithms rather than generalities about quantum computing. Maybe I should say that you'll get no deep thought today. So I'm going to be more specific. And specifically, most of the time, I'm going to be talking about things that the group working on this in the Center for Theoretical Physics at MIT have been doing. We, unlike most of the people in this field, or many of the people in this field, sort of, we come from particle physics rather than computer science. So we have our slightly different take on things, but over the last few years, we've gradually sort of established a common language with the other people working in the field. So we more or less understand each other now. So these are the things I said I would talk about. I will see how the time goes and how much I get interrupted, how much of this I'll be able to do. I'll start by a brief introduction to maybe, I don't know how many people here have even seen these capital letter symbols before. When we started out working in this field, we swore that we would never write papers in which strings of capital letters appeared, but we've had to give up on that. And then I'll talk a little about the two quantum algorithms that sort of started an explosion of interest in the subject after a few people had been working hard for a long time establishing the foundations, but not very many. They were only taking notice of each other, and then it became clear that one could really do things in this field. And then sections 3 and 4 are the two lines that our group at MIT have been following, and I'll talk about at least one of those in rather more detail. Right. A disclaimer, I'm not going to do anything profound. Right? When I start showing you actual calculations briefly, you will say, wait a minute, that's a homework problem in freshman quantum mechanics, and you'll be right. Some of them, which I won't show you, are hard homework problems in a graduate quantum mechanics course. But even so, they don't need... I could wave my hands, and I hopefully, if everyone here, assuming that you are all quantum mechanics rather than computer scientists, am I right about that? Otherwise, I'm going to be very embarrassed. If there are any real experts here, please don't tell me that everything I'm saying is wrong, because I could wave my hands and say you all know that this calculation will go. Okay, so it's all fairly low-level stuff from the point of view of someone used to quantum physics. All right, here's the ante in table of contents. I am not going to be talking about the really interesting part to a physicist, presumably, would be, or at least one of them, would be all the efforts that are going on to actually realize at least the building blocks of a quantum computer. Right, that's by now a big industry, and it's making slow incremental progress. But I'm not going to talk about it at all, on the grounds that I'm a theoretical physicist. I'll not talk about the really subtle stuff that convinces people that one could really do a quantum computer, which is a question of being sure that you can control the errors and if errors occur, you can correct them in some hypothetical machine that would be built. Nothing about that. All right. I'm not going to be talking about the use of a quantum computer or a controllable quantum system, programmable quantum system, if you like, to simulate interesting quantum physical systems, which is the original program that Feynman was talking about 20, 25 years ago, right? That's also made considerable progress. You could even argue that some of it has been done. People working with optical lattices have actually reproduced phenomena in less controllable condensed matter systems. You could say that's a realization of Feynman's program. I'll say nothing whatever, you won't hear the word after this, entanglement, from me. If you look at the literature on this subject, there's a large literature delving away into the way the foundations of quantum mechanics affect what you can do and can't do. Okay, seeing, you know, if I produce an algorithm that's supposed to work on a quantum computer, as I'll show you later, someone could turn around and say, but that isn't really a quantum algorithm. I could build a classical computer that would do exactly the same thing. And trying to distinguish between those things is on very general grounds is a whole industry. It's hard. And for the moment, I'm going to claim that it's not terribly relevant. It hasn't done a lot of good. In that, we, coming from physics, we're a minority in this field. And finally, I'm not going to say anything whatever about the really interesting problems, but except that I don't find them interesting, of transmitting information over quantum and classical channels, the quantum analog of information theory. Well, I will not mention either Alice or Bob or any of their friends, for those who know what I mean. And those who don't, count yourself lucky. All right. So, a brief, highly selective sort of mentioning of words about some of the aspects that are relevant of complexity theory in computer science. So, I mean, you may have seen the words NP, right? The class of decision problems, NP. And I want to say a little about that, just to establish some of the language that I might refer to. Right? I assume you all know the standard model, so to speak, of a classical computer is a Turing machine. You don't need to know what a Turing machine is. If you look in a textbook of computer science, you'll see a definition that looks like a definition in real, pure mathematics, of a formal definition of what a Turing machine is. Whether that is an adequate, a sufficient model for what you would call a realizable computer is something that's not provable. It's something that's been established by consensus over the years. Everyone now believes that anything that can be done on a Turing machine could be done on any kind of computer that any reasonable person would be willing to call a computer, roughly speaking. Now, all we need to know about a Turing machine is that it works with, you put in a string of bits, zeros and ones, on the tape that goes in, the input tape. That's the code for the problem you're trying to solve. Right? What you get out, so far as I'm concerned, is an answer that says either yes or no, or the thing doesn't stop, and you never get either yes or no. We'll only be interested in polynomial time Turing machines. Those are machines that are set up so that they are on any of the class of inputs you're interested in. If the input consists of n bits, it will give you the answer either yes or no in after a number of steps that is bounded by some polynomial in n. Okay? Again, by consensus, that's the definition of a computer that does a feasible calculation. If the thing, instead of being n squared or n cubed, was 2 to the nth, many steps, then that very strictly limits the calculations that you could usefully do. As we discover when we, being our group, when we try and establish some of our things by simulating a hypothetical quantum computer on a classical computer, and we discover that the biggest number of bits we can handle is about 22, which doesn't convince anyone, as I'll say at the end of the talk. Now, there's a class of problems called P by the complexity theorists, and that's simply the class of problems. These things all have extremely precise definitions, and it becomes clear if you look at this that this is a field in which you have to be precise. You have to have the standards of a real mathematician, right? Otherwise you go wrong badly. But there is a precise definition, and so I've got to distinguish between what's a problem, what's a language, and so on. You don't care. The problem's in this class P if there's a polynomial time machine for it. If you can get the answer in polynomial time in the length of the problem. For example, the problem will be relevant to what I'm going to say, the problem that they call 2-sat, right? That's the problem of the input is the problem is there a set of values of a variable z1, z2 up to zn, which each takes the value 0 or 1, which satisfy some set of constraints, and each constraint tells you that a pair of values, zi and zj, mustn't take some particular pair of values. It excludes one of those values. It's usually said in terms of Boolean logic. Right? There's a set of clauses, each involving two variables, and the clause says something like A or B, or A or not B. And in effect, that excludes one pair. Right? In a physicist's language, we're looking at this set of constraints, to what extent it frustrates the problem, right? Can I find a string of Z's which satisfy all the constraints so that none of these clauses none of these values are excluded, right? Clearly, if there are too many constraints, the answer is no, and if there are too few, the answer is yes, and somewhere in between, it gets hard to find out. In fact, it doesn't get very hard. You can easily convince yourself, if you want something to send you to sleep at night, I must have lost the page. Whatever set of constraints you're given, you could decide whether you can satisfy them all or not in polynomial time. You start with one and you work your way through the problem in a fairly obvious way. If you're not concerned with maximum efficiency, it's easy to see how this works, right? So what you do, the definition of the class of problems P is you code the constraints as a string of, bits. I have to tell you which pairs and which particular pair of values is excluded. And I just codify that as zeros and ones, and then I have a long string of bits. That's the length of the problem, the input string. And then I have to construct a Turing machine. When I say a machine, it's already programmed. The machine does is hardwired into it. So given the input, you wait, and out comes the output, a definite output. And there is a polynomial time machine that gives yes if and only if the constraints are satisfied. That's the sort of formal definition of saying that you could solve this problem in polynomial time. All right, just what the computer scientists say, unless I've got it wrong, which is quite likely, right, that the machine accepts the language which consists of those particular bit strings which are codes for satisfiable instances of the problem 2-sat. So there's a problem, there are instances of the problem, which are the particular set of constraints, okay, and then there are the satisfiable instances. And I have to be able to distinguish those from the others. Then the problem, if I can do that in polynomial time, the problem's in P. Oops. However, if I replace 2 by 3, I've got the problem called 3-sat. And then there is no known. That is, each constraint operates on 3 bits rather than 2. It excludes 1 out of the 8 possible triples of values of the three Z's. All right? There's no known polynomial time machine. There's no known polynomial time algorithm that will solve all such problems. And I didn't write this down. I should emphasize, all this stuff is concerned, unfortunately, with the worst case. If I say there is an algorithm that will solve this problem, it has to be able to solve every single instance of the problem, including the worst. Right? There's a whole, of course, practical industry involved in finding not worst case algorithms, but ones that will, say, work with very high probability.
Is there a restriction on the number of constraints in this class of problems? Or?
No, because if you have too many constraints, it becomes easy. Those aren't the hard instances. In fact, I should say this now instead of later. People coming from condensed matter physics have looked at this, of the difficulty in terms of the number of constraints, and very strong evidence that there's a phase transition. Right? Roughly speaking, if you have n bits, you have order of n constraints and a definite multiple, and at that point the problems are hard. Any fewer than that, any more than that, they're easy. It's again difficult to make precisely formulate that, but it's pretty clear that that's what happens. Okay, so you replace three. Nobody's ever been able to find a polynomial time algorithm. In fact, I believe that there is no one who believes that one exists. Instead, you have 3SAT is a typical one of the, it was the first one to be discovered, what is called an NP-complete problem, where NP stands for non-deterministic polynomial, but never mind. That's a piece of obsolete terminology, in fact. Roughly speaking, a problem is in NP if you can check a suggested answer in polynomial time. Okay. If I give you something that purports to be a set of bit values that satisfy all the constraints, it's of course trivial to check, however, in order of n time, whether all those constraints are satisfied. Okay, that puts the problem in NP. Never mind the technical definition. That's roughly speaking, it's made precise in a particular way. As I say, all these satisfiability problems are part of NP. NP complete, the problem is NP complete if you can show that every NP problem can be reduced to the particular NP problem. And the Cook-Levin theorem from the early 70s, showed that 3SAT was such a problem. That if I give you a problem, according to the formal definition of a problem, I can, in polynomial time, transform that problem into the problem of solving a particular 3SAT problem. So if you had an algorithm that would solve 3SAT, then you could solve all the NP-complete problems. And if you look in the appropriate library, you'll find a book that lists 300 NP-complete problems, some of which are interesting, right, to anyone. Anyone will find some of those problems interesting. I should have said that. That way
around. The transformation is highly non-trivial.
But it has to be doable in polynomial time. Usually they're fairly trivial.
Oh, they are?
Some require a lot of ingenuity and some don't.
Like transforming a traveling salesman to 3SAT?
Yeah, that's not that hard. You do it in a sequence of steps. Okay. You know, that's once you've learned a repertoire of tricks, there's a finite number of them. I believe. Anyone interested? If you go to the Clay Institute website, there's a note for those who wish to earn $1 million by showing that NP is the same as P or not the same as P. Everyone believes it's not the same as P, but that's one of the famous unsolved problems of the 21st century in mathematics. And there's a note by Cook himself, which is brief and lucid. On the subject, and we'll show you just how subtle, if you read it, just how subtle all this is. Okay. The point of all this is I want to talk briefly about the quantum analog of a Turing machine and of the class NP. Well, I'm not going to even describe it. The quantum analog of a Turing machine is what's called the circuit model of a quantum computer. That's a thing built out of building blocks called gates, just as a classical computer is. Right? And what a gate does, it works on some small number, usually 2 or 3, or even 1, of qubits. Those are just two-dimensional quantum Hilbert space objects, like a spin half. Okay? And what each gate does to the qubits is does a unitary transformation on them. That unitary transformation is then selected from some standard set of simple unitary transformations, and you can show there are various standard sets, and you can show that by combining them polynomial number of times, you can do well, and you can approximate well enough for what you want to do any unitary transformation. So again, that's a whole prehistory of this field that I'm not going to go into, showing how you can break down a big unitary transformation on a system of n qubits into a sequence of small steps, so to speak, which gives you the hope that you could build something that's the analog of a digital computer. Okay. Now the analog of one of the achievements that I like seem to be very natural of the people who've been thinking about, you know, in the way that computer scientists think about complexity problems, about quantum computers, is the analog of the class of problems NP. That's called the class QMA, and I am too embarrassed to tell you what Q stands for quantum, and I'm not going to tell you what M and A stand for, because it embarrasses me about the company I'm keeping. This was worked out by Alexei Kitaev, who's a condensed matter theorist by trade originally. And the definition goes like you have your input is a state x1, x2, xn of n qubits. So these are the z components of the spin halves. Right? It's in that particular basis. Right? Oh, and I missed out. Then you have another system, which is supposed to be the answer that you're checking, right? Which is some state, not a basis state, but some one of the any linear combinations of the basis states of a different set of qubits, and there may even be n squared or n cubed of them, right? And then you have a polynomial time quantum machine of the kind I just mentioned. And then you're supposed to check, you're given y, and you're supposed to check whether your quantum Turing machine, it spits out an answer. You make a measurement at the end of the quantum computation, and the measurement gives you either 0 or 1. You measure 1 qubit, in effect. I'm not saying this accurately for anyone who knows or goes on and reads about this. All right? And you're supposed to distinguish between the cases where there is a y such that the measurement in which the input is x and y is 0 with probability greater than with high probability, and the cases where it's 0 with low probability. And if you repeat this enough times, you can distinguish between the cases. You have to have the probability in here because of the nature of a quantum measurement. And if this is the case, then the original problem of deciding whether x satisfies your conditions or not is in QMA. I let me not pretend that you could follow that if you hadn't seen it before.
All right. No.
It's just that they're separated. You have to be able to, one's bigger than a half, the other's less than half. Yeah. And then, the interesting thing about this is that Kitaev was able to show that that the equivalent, in some sense, of that three-sat problem, that is a QMA complete problem, if you could find a polynomial time machine, quantum machine, that would solve this problem, then you'd be able to solve all the problems in QMA, which means you would also be able to solve all the NP problems, because 3-sat is a special case of this. You could always turn quantum into classical as a special case of quantum, just by going to diagonal bases. This one, you're given a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of operators, each of which act on at most 3 spins, 3 qubits, right? And the M, as in QMA, gives you this problem, and he promises you that the ground state energy of this Hamiltonian is either less than zero or bigger than something positive, and it's got to be positive by some polynomial in 1 over n, the length of the number of bits, and you're supposed to find out which. And all the numbers in this are given to a precision which is given by n bits, right, 2 to the nth, 1 over 2 to the nth. Okay, then you prove, Kataev proves that this is a QMA complete problem. So this is just a sample of the kind, a taste of the kind of thing that the people who let themselves be influenced by the complexity theorists are able to do about quantum computation. Not the kind of thing we've been doing. And I took too long over it. Okay. How am I doing? That's all right. So let me move on and give you an example of the kind of problem that a quantum computer, I mean, this will help to show what kind of thing a quantum computer, how a quantum computer would work, in this purely theorist way of describing it, the kind of problem that you can show a quantum computer solves much faster than any classical computer could. The famous one, the one that's got most publicity, is Shor's algorithm for factorizing large numbers. Okay, that's a little too complicated for me to describe. Let me describe, in fact, its immediate predecessor, which is what Shor built on. And the predecessors, it's due to Simon, there's a whole series of steps before this, but it is as follows. You're given a function of y equals f of x, where x and y are just a string of n bits, so a string of zeros and ones, n of them. All right. I've said this is a function from the group z2 to the nth to the group z2 to the nth, because it's a special case of what's called a hidden coset problem. Right, it's been generalized to cover any abelian group, and then there are more complicated generalizations for non-abelian groups. The thing Shor had to do was replace, this is not the way it was said when he was doing it, but it's now clear that that's what he was doing. He replaces this group z2 to the nth by z2 to the nth, that is, the set of numbers 0, 1, 2, all the way up to 2 to the nth minus 1, with addition modulo 2 to the nth. Now, you're given a function, and you're told that f only depends on a particular subset of the x's of the bits. So it's independent of the rest. And then on these take 2 to the nth values, and f takes 2 to the nth different values. Right. In this case, you're given a function which has a period, r, where r is some factor of 2 to the nth, and you're supposed to find the period. Here you're supposed to find what are i1 up to im, which are the bits this thing depends on, and which doesn't it depend on. All right. The reason this has something to do with factorization, right, so Shor needs to find the repetition period r of this function f, right, is that r has to be a factor of n. And you, with a little not very difficult number theory, right, you can see how you could, if you could solve this problem, you could factorize a big number. I take that back, the number theory isn't that simple. You need to know things like the probability of two numbers being prime, co-prime, and stuff like that. But it's all known, it's all standard. All right? Now, I say you're given the function. I have to be careful. What does that mean in a quantum computer? All right? And you're given it as a quantum operation. You're given a black box, right? In which, if you insert the state, and this black box consists of n qubits labeled by, which I put into the state labeled by x, and then a single extra qubit No, no, n more qubits, sorry, all of which are set at zero, that is, all the spins that are representing these qubits are pointing up, shall we say, right? And then it operates a unity transformation, and out comes x and f of x, right? If this was all classical, this would be, I would put into my machine a tape with x printed on it, and n blank zeros, and out would come x reprinted and the values of f. Okay, but this is supposed to be, this is a crucial point, this is supposed to be a quantum oracle. This is the function f is hidden inside this box. This, put this in, out comes this. Which means that put this in, out comes this. So, by a single operation of this box, I have the entire, what I could think of as a table, entire table of the function f. Right, which looks as if I've sort of gained 2 to the nth, a factor of 2 to the nth, that instead of, in order to get the function f from a classical thing, I'd have to feed in x equals 1, x equals 2, x equals 3, or do it all in parallel. Here I do it automatically in parallel by doing this. However, that's a fraud. It's all very well, but the question is, what good does it do you? If I measure this, right, what will I find? Well, suppose I measure this, f of x, I make a measurement of this set of variables, these n qubits. I'll get some answer, one of the possible values that f of x takes, and then I'll get the superposition of all the x's that are in that answer, that give that answer. So, what I get is I measure that second register, f only depends on x1 to the xm, so what I get out is this summed over all values of the remaining x's with these fixed at some set of x's chosen at random, but I don't know which. And if you think about it, you'll see that that's no great help as it stands. That's exactly what a classical computer would do for this problem. Right? However, you can now take advantage of not just of the superposition that you have in quantum mechanics, right, but of the changes of basis that you can do in quantum mechanics. You can do a unity transformation on each of these, on each of the n bits. And the unity transformation is just this. It's a rotation through pi over 4 about the y-axis of the spin. Right. That's easy. You can easily see you could realize that on with a sufficiently restricted error on a on any possible quantum machine that anyone's thinking about. Right. And if you do this, what you'll get for the first m bits, since each is in a state either up or down, you'll get one or other of these states, which is a state in which the spin is pointing in the x direction, either the plus or minus x direction. Whereas on these, you'll always get zero. Because those are summed over the two values of x. So zero, each is zero plus one, and zero plus one goes into zero. So now, if you measure all the x's after you've done these transformations, right, you'll certainly get zero for the bits n plus 1 to n. Remember, you don't know which are n plus 1 to n. That's what you're trying to find out. And you'll get, with probability a half, 0 or 1 for the others. So now you just keep on doing it 10 times. Right, and you do it sufficient number of times, it doesn't have to be very big, you'll be able to tell which ones are the ones you're looking for, which give zero every time. Okay? Now, of course, I did this example. It's simple to describe because this transformation I did, the so-called Hadamard transformation, is it's just a product of the transformation on each bit, a tensor product. Right? The one that Shor had to use on this bit, other group, instead of doing the Hadamard transformation, he has to do a Fourier transform. Okay, the Fourier transform is a unitary transformation. R and S each go from 0 up to 2 to the nth minus 1, and the elements are this. Right? It's like it's just the transformation from the position to the momentum basis, but on a discrete set of points arranged in a circle. Okay. So first you have to show, and that had already been done when Shor did this, that you can do this on a quantum machine in n squared steps. This is the quantum adaptation of the fast Fourier transform algorithm, standard classical algorithm that does a Fourier transform in n times 2 to the nth steps, if you look at it. So the crucial speed up, one of the crucial speed ups, is here. This is yet another aspect of the things that a quantum computer could do for you. Okay? All right. Now, I have to say this. Let me briefly describe the other algorithm that was very shortly after Shor, because many of the things we do are analogous to it. That's the algorithm discovered by Lov-Grover. It's of a rather different nature. Well, no, it's again, you're looking for something that's hidden inside a black box. Right? You've got a set of states X. This time the fact that X is a bit string is irrelevant. There are just capital N values of X, which form the basis for a Hilbert space. And your black box is a unity transformation, which if you put in the state X, gives you either X or minus X. All right. There are other ways of saying this, but you have to show they're all equivalent. All right. So the one you're looking for, there's a particular value of X, which I call W, for which the unity transformation changes the sign of X, changes the phase of the state. Okay. This kind of black box is the computer scientists call an oracle. And again, it's crucial that it's a quantum oracle, that if I take a superposition of the X's, I'll get the appropriate superposition here. It's a unitary transformation. Okay? And now, so I can write down what UW is. It's this. 1 minus twice the projection on the state W. And I want to do this example not so much because of the interest of the Grover algorithm, but it gives you the sort of theoretical way of describing what an algorithm looks like. Right, of this kind. What I have to do is find a starting state S, which I could set my computer into, and a series of unity transformations, V1 up to VK, which have to be realizable as each operating on some small number of bits, or product of such things. And then I have to operate with U, with V, with U, with V, with U, with V, with U, with V, in such a way that if the state hidden in the black box is W, out comes W at the end. Then I measure all the bits, and that will tell me what thing I'm looking for is. Now, the details, this turns out to be very easy with hindsight. Grover's solution, and you can show that it's the best possible, is you take the starting state just to be the uniform superposition of all the states X, which is a reasonable thing to do. In fact, you could have found this by just demanding that your solution is invariant under the permutation group on all the states. Not the way Grover found it. Not even the way we failed to find it. And then for V's, you take the same thing but with S instead of W. 1 minus twice SS. And that means you can work in the two-dimensional subspace spanned by S and W, and it turns out that VU is just this just the rotation by a small angle delta, which is of order 1 over root n. So it takes you have to repeat order root n times. All right? It's an elementary calculation. Once you've decided that this is the kind of thing you're supposed to be doing, and you find that you take order root n queries, whereas clearly, and if you don't like clearly, then by using classical information theory, it has to take you order n queries of a classical oracle that tells you whether you put in x and it either says yes or no. Until you get to w, it says yes. Well, you have to try at least half, on average, half of them, because you can't do any better by any amount of ingenuity, clearly. So you get this speed up from n to root n, which is, if n is really big, is appreciable. Okay, it's not what is called an exponential speed up. We should think of capital N as being 2 to the little n. Then this takes me from 2 to the little n to 2 to the little n over 2, which matters, but not as much as going from 2 to the nth to n, which would be maybe repay the cost of building the quantum computer. It's interesting, actually, that the fact that this was the best you could do on a quantum computer was proved before Grover found the algorithm, and if you look at the proof and see where it differs from the corresponding classical proof, you discover that what you've done is replace the L1 norm by an L2 norm on some set. Right? It's because probability is mob psi squared in classical, in quantum mechanics. Okay. So, there's a brief description of the two famous quantum algorithms. Practically all the quantum algorithms that have been developed since 1997, when Grover did his, are variations on this theme. All, except ours. That's a claim, I'll make it, but it wouldn't surprise me if it turned out to be false. Right? Someone may show that the ones we've got are actually just variations on one of these themes. But it doesn't look like at the moment. Let me talk about our quantum walk algorithms. That's just various papers. Anyone interested in following up on this, you can get these references from me. What I have to do is contrast a classical random walk on a graph with what we call a quantum walk. We're not so sure that this analogy has anything in it, is of any meaning, but it's the way we got to this. It is only an analogy. This may just be words. Lots of classical algorithms consist of doing a random walk and to find the answer. The answer is hidden in there, and you start here, and you have to work your way through something, a graph. All right? Whether what we're doing can reasonably be called a quantum random walk is just words. So I'll show you what we do. We work, by the way, always, as I said, in continuous time. We think of a quantum system developing according to the Schrödinger equation, whereas the computer science people like to think of a sequence of unity transformations. They're the same thing. It's easy to show that anything you can do one way, you can do the other way. If you want e to the iht, you could write it as a sequence of standard unity transformations, provided the h itself only operates on is a sum of terms, each of which operates on a few bits at a time. There's a whole set of questions you have to be careful about here. I'm not going to even hint at those here. All right, so. A classical random walk on a graph, the graph consists of a set of nodes. This graph has two nodes connected by a single edge. All right, this is the trivial example. I said I was going to do freshman quantum mechanics homework problems. This is freshman, it's not exactly classical mechanics, because a system that consists of just two points is indeed the simplest classical mechanical system, but you don't usually discuss it. It's a classical analog of a spin half. I would claim. And you're either at A or B, and if you're at B, you jump to A with a probability KAB dt in time dt, probability of a unit time. All right? In which case, the probability that you're at A obeys this equation, sum over all the nodes connected to A. You were at B with probability PB, and then you jump to A. And then you have to subtract the probability that if you were at A to start with, you jumped out to some other node, which is just this. Right? And I could write this like this, which includes KAA. And the condition on K is that all the off-diagonal elements of the matrix K are positive, and that the sum of each column of a matrix K is zero. We get into terrible trouble having discussions with the mathematicians and computer scientists because they always write their matrices the other way around. However, right, in which case, probability is conserved. Right, that's a simple classical random walk. By a random walk on a graph, the ones I'll talk about, I have a graph which I'll call capital G. Certain nodes are connected by edges. And I'll take KAB to be some constant gamma, if and only if AB is in the graph. Be clear what I mean in a minute. I'll give you an example, several examples. So that, in that case, KAA is minus gamma times what's called the degree of A, just the number of nodes connected to A. And the graphs we'll be interested in will always have, nearly always, not always, D of A small, 2 or 3, 4, which means that the matrix K would be sparse. All right. Now, by what we mean by a quantum walk, it's really just comes from looking at that equation from the rate of change of the probability, seeing it's a linear equation, and say, why, that looks like the Schrödinger equation. That's all there is to the choice of words. Right. I think of a Hilbert space with a basis, A, one orthogonal state for each node. I have a Hamiltonian A, whose matrix elements are all zero, except for the matrix element BHA, which is equal to what I previously called KAB. The off-diagonal matrix elements are there if the two nodes are connected on the graph. All right. And this time I'll take the diagonal elements to be zero. They don't really matter. For most of the further, that's not quite true, but it'll be true for what I'm going to say. Because wait a minute, I'm getting out of order here. All I need for conservation of probability, this is the difference. Conservation of probability for this quantum walk only requires that KAB equal KBA, that I have a Hermitian matrix for the Hamiltonian. These are real numbers, they're all equal to gamma or zero. So long as that matrix is symmetric, right, I don't have a condition that the sum of the elements of the of a column has to be zero to have probability conserved, and that's because the probability is mod psi a squared. This is the fundamental difference between the quantum dynamics and the classical Markov process. Right? I mean, don't be misled by the fact that you could write for finite dimensional systems, any quantum system in such a way that this linear thing, apart from the I, itself looks like a classical random walk. That's true, but useless, so far as I know. Right. When you think of... No, let me not go into it. I take too long. It's a distraction. Now, the point is the time evolution is very different. Example one, I just take these two points. If I look at the classical random walk, I've got this. And you immediately see that the probability, whatever I start with, I tend to the state in which I've got probability a half of being at A and B, very fast. Time, as soon as gamma T is reasonably large. Right? Whereas, if I did the same thing with the quantum walk, right, I told you I was doing freshman quantum mechanics, I discover that PA is cos squared gamma T and PB is sine squared gamma T if I start at A. And so after time pi over 2 gamma, I'm at B. Mm-hmm. Because of the interference that's going on between the states A and B. That's childish. The next example is I look at a hypercube. This is a cube, but it works just as well for a hypercube. A hypercube, of course, is just a tensor product of n of that previous example with just two nodes. So it's n independent, either classical bits or quantum bits. So if I start at the node 0, 0, 0, 0, right, classically, the probability that I get to the node 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, the other opposite diagonal of the hypercube, tends to 1 over capital N, which is 2 to the nth. Capital N always stands for 2 to the little n for me. Never gets big. Whereas in the quantum case, provided I could carefully tune this gamma accurately so that each of the all the gammas are in effect the same, but be careful, but it works, then I'm certainly at 1, 1, 1 after a certain time. Completely different behavior. Now, the reason I introduced this example is to show this. We look at this another way, all right? Both the probability in the classical case and the wave function in the quantum case only depend on what's called the Hamming weight. That's the sum of I1, I2, IN, which if I go back to my picture of, well, if I look at the picture of the hypercube, it's the distance I am from the starting vertex. Well, it just makes slices across the hypercube. At the slice with weight W, there are N choose W points. Okay, I choose W1s in the bit string. And there are N choose W ways of doing that. So if I can reduce the problem to a walk on the line, provided I start in the state 0, 0, 0, 0, which is the only state with Hamming weight 0. All right? If you look at the classical thing, when you reduce it to a point, walk on a line, you have a probability of being in this particular slice, and then the probability of jumping from here to here is n minus w, from jumping from here to here is w. Okay? So you're, if on the left, you're driven to the right, and if you're on the right, you're driven to the left. And in fact, you get stuck in the middle. If you start at zero and do a random walk this way, you find yourself stuck in the middle. And that's why you've got such a small probability of finishing up here. Right? It's this exponential small probability that there's a fluctuation in this random wandering around near the middle that takes you all the way to the end. Different way of looking at the same thing. In fact, you end up, you end up with this distribution, just a binomial distribution. Whereas if you look at the corresponding quantum walk, the numbers are different. You have an equal probability of going from here to here or from here to here. This is the amplitude, not the probability, which is this. And you solve the Schrodinger equation, and of course you finish up the same answer you got by doing the calculation before reducing it to a line with this distribution. It's always a binomial distribution, but the probability changes with time, right? And the average value of W is n sine squared gamma t, and after time pi over 2 gamma, you're at the far end with certainty. Right? It's completely different behavior. Now, the third example, modification of this one, and then I'm going to do the fourth example, which is where the payoff comes, is back-to-back trees. That back-to-back trees, right? I just have a my graph consists of a bifurcating tree till I get to 2 to the nth points, and then it shrinks back again to 1 point. I've called this entrance and this exit. And if you started here and asked how long a classical random walk would take to get you there, again, you get stuck in the center. Right. You remember, you've got equal probability of jumping along any of these edges, so you're more likely to go this way than this way. You've got two ways to go to the right and one way to the left. Okay. The quantum walk reduces to this, oddly enough. You would think something would happen, there'd be a defect in the middle, but it's not true. It's just an accident, the way I've written it, depending on my choice of the diagonal elements of H, actually. But in any case, it reduces to this, and if you now examine that problem, which is a slightly more sophisticated homework problem in quantum mechanics, where is it? Well, okay, I've got out of order. You have to calculate the propagator on a discrete line, on a line of points like that. All right, that's just a Bessel function. the probability of going from m to n in time, the amplitude to go from m to n in time t is jn minus nt. And if n is big, the maximum value of that is when t is equal to n, and it's of order 1 over n to the third. The fact that I'm actually working on a line with only n points, not infinitely many, then just means I bounce to and fro, just get repetitions by reflections. And that means, in fact, though I won't show you the details, that if I let this Hamiltonian evolution take place for time n, and then repeat of order certainly n times, and probably less, n to the 2/3 times, I can get a high probability of finishing up at the exit. If you don't think too hard about what I just said, because an hour ago I started to think hard about whether I could justify what I just said, and decided I'd have trouble. It's true, however. I know it's true, but I can't give you the argument. This final thing about the probability is, for some reason, escaping me. A simple argument is escaping me. Now, what's all this got to do with solving problems? What's the problem I'm solving? Well, the problem I'm solving is, again, it's a problem with an oracle. Right, I have a black box. Each node has a name, chosen from some big list of names. Say, not n bits, but n squared bits. Much bigger than the number of possible nodes. Right, and I don't know what those names are. This is how we sell this to the National Security Agency. The black box, I put in a name, and it spits out the names of the, this is the classical black box, the names of the neighboring nodes. Okay, and I'm handed on a piece of paper the name of the entrance, the thing I call the entrance node. I'm told the structure of the, and I know the general structure of the graph. I know something about the structure of the graph. I'm given the name of the entrance, and my problem is to find the name of the exit by querying the black box. Applying pressure. And I want to do it in as few queries as possible. Well, classically, in effect, that means take a random walk on the graph. Okay? I get to a certain point, I know the name I'm at, I ask the names of the neighbors. I don't go back where I was, presumably, so I strike that one out. I keep track of, I have a choice about how much I keep track of where I've been. But whatever I do on the, if I just do an ordinary random walk, I'll get stuck in the middle. Okay? Now, the thing I won't show you is that the thing I call the quantum walk Hamiltonian, the things whose matrix elements on that line were all equal to 1, is something that you could get if you're given this quantum black box. The quantum black box, again, you put in a state which is labeled with the name, and it gives you, it spits out, right, the names of the neighbors. I'll describe more carefully what that is in 1 second. I'm almost through. Okay. A little ingenuity, however, makes the classical random walk work. All you have to do is you could check whether you're at the center, because the center looks different from everywhere else. And if after you've been to the center, you've made 2k, you find yourself back there after 2k moves, you know you turned around after k. So you go back k moves. So that doesn't require very great ingenuity. The same problem on the hypercube, by the way, requires enough ingenuity that it defeated us, but we have a friend who told us how to do it. Now I modify that back-to-back tree problem by introducing in the center random connections, so that each one on here is connected to two on here, and each one here is connected to two on here. That is, I choose a cycle that goes all the way around there and back. All right? That looks like, if I have 128 nodes in the middle, looks like this. Okay? And again, you have an oracle that tells you the names of the neighbors, and you're supposed to come in here. Getting to here is easy. You just keep on going forward. And once you've got to here, it's easy to go, you can go to there by the process I just described. All right, but what do you do to get across there? All right. Our collaborator, Daniel Spielman, who's an expert on the classical theory of all this, he proved that that any classical algorithm that makes at most 2 to the n over 6 queries can only find the exit with probability at most 2 to the minus n over 6. It does it by producing a series of successively easier problems, which each of which, if you could solve, you could solve the harder one. I can't follow the proof, but he swears it's a proof. There's an odd thing about the quantum work for this problem. You do exactly the same thing as I did for the simple back-to-back trees, and discover that you get this, that provided you're dealing with states which have the same amplitude on all the nodes in a column, the fact that you've made these random connections in the center doesn't make any difference. I can't figure out what that corresponds to in any other quantum system. Right? There happen to be symmetric solutions, even though the Hamiltonian isn't symmetric. In any case, all that does is introduce a defect at the center. That makes no essential difference. It just introduces a few more bouncings to and fro, and you could figure it all out, and once again, you get n to the third. Okay, and this can indeed be implemented. I won't say anything about the details. And I guess I'm out of time, so I will not talk about our other. This we claim is the, not that anyone seems to care very much, this we claim is the only example of an exponential speed up from 2 to the nth to n of an algorithm for a problem that is not essentially the same as the based on the quantum Fourier transform or its analogs. Of course, it's obviously an extremely contrived problem, right? We finally figured out the problem in order to have a solution.
You invented the problem.
We invented the problem, yeah. Well, with a little help from, I've been putting down the computer scientists with more than a little help from our computer science friends.
But the problem wasn't around.
No. Well, the problems of this type were certainly around. Yeah, problems of this type are known problems. There are problems that they would be on about graphs that would be much more interesting, that we put a lot of effort into trying to solve in similar ways, but we can't do it. The problem of deciding when two graphs are isomorphic. Right? You can make look a little like this, but not well enough to. Every now and again, we think we've solved it, but it goes away, usually fast. So I did not get to, and will not abuse your patience, our other general method. I'll just say one sentence, two sentences about it. Our other general method, which is what we call the quantum adiabatic evolution algorithm, in which we try and we solve the problem by putting the system into a ground state of a Hamiltonian. We get the system into the ground state by starting in the ground state of another Hamiltonian and slowly changing. So we have a set of spins, we put them in a strong transverse magnetic field so they're all lined up, and then switch off the magnetic field, and then there are various couplings that represent the problem, and we want to be in the bound state. All right. It's an obvious idea. It's an obvious idea. And it obviously doesn't work, because in interesting problems, at some point in the evolution, the gap between the ground state and the first excited state will be small. And that means you'll have to go very slowly to avoid making a transition. All right? And then the question is, can we find a class of interesting, hard, classical problems for which we could show that, in some sense, some typical gap is not small? Of course, if we could solve that, we wouldn't say it was quantum computation. We would have solved an interesting problem in spin glass theory or something like that. And this is where we've done a lot of numerical simulations. The results are interesting, but not convincing, because we can't go to more than 20 odd bits. After that, the capacity of a classical computer is rapidly exceeded. If you're trying to simulate the solution of a Schrödinger equation, or find the eigenvalues even of a sparse matrix that's 2 to the nth by 2 to the nth. The real problem, the difficulty is, well, one of the difficulties is being sure that you're selecting your instances of a problem from something that the classical people will admit are hard instances. And there are some who will say, basically, any way you select, there'll be some algorithm that will solve it, unless you do a worst case altogether. It's very tricky. Oh, I'll stop there.
Questions, David?
So, essentially, you've discovered, or I must say, problem repetitive, but still a special kind of problem where quantum mechanics works especially well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something like the fast Fourier transform.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. Let me make a confession. When we showed that problem with the exponential speed up to two of the MIT computer scientists, who I won't name because they might not stick to it, they immediately said, oh, that's just the fast Fourier transform. I do not, but we couldn't pin them down. They have never shown us what they meant by that.
Because that, what I was wondering was, can you combine these? The obvious thing would be to have a whole bunch of these special tools that could be or five
of them. We have not been able to.
Second question was, there are people who claim that qubits isn't the right approach, that one should code information differently in order to have stability from mechanical.
Yeah.
Use
anyons, whatever. Yeah.
Have you thought about that? Are these algorithms really require the more classical qubit thing, or could they be implemented?
No, I mean, they could be implemented. I mean, unless you're badly wrong, all these different models of a computer are supposed to be equivalent. Just like you could try something other than a Turing machine. I mean, in the early days, people came up with different models of what a classical computation was, and it became clear that they were all reducible into each other. So the confidence that you weren't missing something by restricting yourself to a Turing machine grew. And I think the same is true of these other models. They might make it more efficient to achieve the coherence that you need to do an actual computation. But I think most people believe that they were just another way of realizing the same theoretical circuit model.
Other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Jeffrey again.